On today's program, we're talking about Wild Mercy, Living the Fierce and Tender Wisdom of the Women Mystics with author Maribai Starr. I'm Richard Brendan, and you're listening to Journey's Fire. Maribai Starr writes creative nonfiction and contemporary translations of sacred literature. She taught philosophy and world religions at the University of New Mexico, Taos, for 20 years and now teaches and speaks internationally on contemplative practice, compassionate action, and the teachings of the mystics across the spiritual traditions. She's the author of God of Love, Caravan of No Despair, and other acclaimed works. She lives in Taos, New Mexico, and from that beautiful area of our country, she joins us today. Maribai Starr, thank you so much for being on the program.
Oh, my pleasure, Richard. Thanks for inviting me.
This has been an honor for me. I've followed your work over the years, and actually, I first heard about this new book, Wild Mercy, on one of my favorite people's emails. He's been on the show several times, and that's Father Richard Rohr. You're dear friends with him.
Aww.
And he quoted you in one of his emails and some things that you had to say. But also, this book is so timely. And it's really timely because as I was thinking about this interview, I happened to catch a little bit of Morning Joe this morning. Mm-hmm. And the topic was, are Americans ready for a female president? And can a woman actually beat a man? And you had some pretty heady, you know, progressive people on both sides of that.
Yeah.
So we'll get into that a little bit. But this book has been a gift for me. I read somewhere, which I found interesting, given the amount of writing that you've done, that the compiling, I guess, the manuscript for Wild Mercy was actually extremely hard for you.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that?
You know, I've been dedicated to finding the jewels in all the world's spiritual traditions my entire adult life, and I've not found that difficult. You know, it's been very easy to sort of find those wisdom streams that connect all the world's great traditions, spiritual and religious. And yet, when I chose to focus on the feminine, thinking it would be just as easy as anything else that I have done, I discovered that the wisdom teachings of women had been so successfully, and I believe intentionally, buried that you had to be, I had to be kind of an archaeologist of spiritual teachings to really find them and excavate them and bring them up. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's just a coinkydink. I think that the existing prevailing structures of religion and spirituality, as well as everything else across the human communities, politics and science, the sciences and even the arts, have been largely designed by and for a kind of masculine paradigm.
Yeah.
And the women have been sidelined because that, you know, it just has, the feminine wisdom teachings are subversive in light of the prevailing, you know, ways of looking at the world and looking at the human spirit.
Absolutely, they are. What would you consider as the key jewels, or let's say gems, kind of using that analogy of digging deep into the ground, mm-hmm. From feminine wisdom teaching that it's highlighted in this book and why they're so important today?
You know, I'm not making this up. This is very kind of commonly accepted that there are certain feminine values, and they exist in women,
mm-hmm.
But they also abide in the soul of every human being, in men and in people of all genders. And this book is really reaching out to people of all genders and no particular, you know, gender identity, at least in binary terms. So that's really important to say when I speak about these feminine attributes or values. I'm speaking about that range of what's important and what is transformational in all human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So having said that, I'm speaking about qualities like being more heart-centered than head-centered, being relational, that is inclusive, and aware of the other, not as other, but as part of the web of interbeing to which each of us belongs. So, but relationships and feelings And things like this are not only accepted, but are important and need to be centered in any conversation that has to do with the inner awakening and service in the world, these values of relationship. Another thing, jewels to me of the feminine, or gem, is the way in which the feminine can make a space for paradox and ambiguity, such that, again, they're not problems to be solved, as they are from a more analytical masculine headset, mindset, but rather are the beautiful landscape of the feminine is, it includes, it's about, it's rooted in mystery. And so we don't have to have black and white answers to everything. In fact, there is a kind of mistrust of exclusionary thinking, black and white answers, like let's look at the world as some kind of busted gizmo that we need to repair, but rather looking at the pain of the world as a way that penetrates the heart and opens the field of the heart so that we have the capacity to respond from that place of love, and rather than of a kind of mechanistic, you know, model of solving problems, but actually allowing ourselves to feel it all, and feeling and experiencing contradictory things, like, for instance, in grief and loss, which is one of, you know, my areas. Oh, and yours too. that there is often, whether it's at the bedside of the dying, or whether it's in the experience of a bereaved person, this simultaneous deep experience of heartbreak, of what I would call unbearable anguish, and at the same time, present in that same broken open heart, is this often this sense of proximity to the sacred, this numinous sweetness that is true too. And for the feminine, that's not a contradiction. It's just the way it is.
Yeah. You write in the introduction that this is a party that's been unfolding for millennia, and the hosts are women mystics from all the branches of soul family. It reminded me something Meister Eckhart used to say, one river, many wells, or one well, many rivers. And I've always believed that. But you also said this gathering is secret simply because historically for wise women to gather openly has been to risk death, but their love and clarity and beauty are profoundly, urgently needed. That I would agree with wholeheartedly. Are you finding through the years with your work that society is becoming more open to the mystical teachings, the feminine?
Definitely. Well, society is becoming more open to mystical teachings. You know, the popularity of poets like Rumi and Hafiz and other Sufi poets. So funny because, you know, there's such a severe case of Islamophobia in America, and yet the most popular poets in America really are Rumi and Hafiz, who are Sufis, the mystical branch of Islam. But, so I think that there's been an appetite that's been growing for the beautiful, poetic, heart-centered teachings of the mystics. I've certainly found, as a translator of the Spanish mystics, John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, that I've, you know, received an increase in invitations to speak and teach about them over the years. Mm-hmm. But specifically the feminine, we're just barely beginning, I think, to center the voices of the women mystics in that general conversation.
One of the things I've been curious about, you don't cover this in the book, but, and I've never really studied this, you do talk about St. Teresa and John of the Cross, who I dearly love his writings as well, and hers. I've often found that when I study the mystics, that there's often a male-female counterpart. Now, I don't know if that's always the case, but because I think about St. Francis, some have said actually that there's more of a feminine mystic in him, in a male body.
I've said that.
But he had Claire, you know, in his life.
Right.
Jesus had Mary Magdalene. I don't know if there's a masculine feminine thing going on, or it's just a coincidence. So,
yeah, no, I don't think it's a coincidence. I think you're onto something there, and I think it has to do with the masculine and feminine in each of our own being that is often sort of bifurcated by virtue of the conditioning we receive in society that just breaks everything down.
Yes.
It's a very dualistic world that we live in. But I also think there is something about the lover-beloved language that we find in every one of the mystics across the spiritual traditions, even in indigenous traditions, less in indigenous traditions, which is an interesting question in itself. But the language, like in the Song of Songs, of the bride who, you know, makes love with the bridegroom, and then he disappears, and she has to go looking for him, and she's desperately looking for him. And we see it in the Gita Govinda in Hinduism of Radha and Krishna, you know, the longing, the coming together, the being separated, and then the longing for reunification. We find it in Judaism in the Shekhinah, who's exiled, except on Shabbat.
Yes.
When she returns and has union with her beloved again, and then the whole world becomes reunified and comes back into balance when the masculine and feminine come together, you know, and find each other and attain that perfect, you know, equivalency, and then all the dualism just melts, and there's only love left.
Your prayer to the Shekhinah is incredibly powerful. It was for me.
Thank you, Richard.
Did that just like come? Did you just download that?
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of people have been sharing that prayer since it came out. Yes. Yeah, so a very simple answer to that is that when I was offered this book, it was the idea of the publisher, and I said yes, I'd love to. I sat down and wrote that prayer as an invocation for myself. To be able to write the book. Like, I needed her to open the way for me, her meaning the Shekhinah, which in Judaism is the indwelling feminine face of the divine.
Yeah.
And she, so that was my invocation. That was my, please, I can't do this myself. You do it. You know, I need you to do it. And that's where that came from. So yes, it came all as a whole piece.
Speak to the meaning of the title. You've chosen two very powerful words in and of themselves, wild and mercy.
That's, you know, what it comes back to, kind of what we spoke about at the beginning of this conversation, where I said that the feminine is at home with ambiguity and with paradox. In fact, that's her very nature, you know, and so the feminine, the sacred feminine, is not only about mercy and compassion and loving kindness, which she certainly is, all those kind of obviously maternal aspects, at least in the Divine Mother, if not in most of our actual biological or adoptive mothers. But the feminine principle is, of course, loving and kind and forgiving. But she's also unpredictable. She's wildly creative. She's subversive. She speaks truth to power and doesn't hold back. You know, and again, I'm speaking of the feminine in all of us.
That
ability to just, you know, it's like the Dakini in Tibetan Buddhism, who's this wild spirit, feminine spirit, that disrupts and overturns the way we think things are supposed to be in favor of this kind of laser-like clarity, you know, Kali and Durga in the Hindu tradition.
And in walking that balance of wild and mercy, I'm thinking flows out of what you have called, and I would call, cultivating a contemplative life. That's really important, isn't it?
Absolutely, Richard. The thing about, I mean, people often think about a meditation practice as just a stress reduction, you know, technique to design to make you kind of bland and not caring,
yes.
You know, so that things just roll off your back. And for me, a contemplative life, it's not the opposite of that, but it's much more than just finding equanimity and the ability to sustain a peaceful stance in the midst of challenging circumstances, but rather, or in addition, what a contemplative practice, like a meditation practice or walking in the woods mindfully with your breath or sitting at the bedside of the dying or whatever your way of showing up fully and being completely present may be, it enables us then to go back out into the world also with that ability to stay present with what is rather than our whole internal story about what should be. You know, we're able to actually show up for the fullness of reality with a tender and loving heart. I mean, Richard Rohr, who you evoked at the beginning of this conversation, speaks about contemplative life as something like seeing through the eyes of, looking through the eyes of love.
Yes.
And seeing only love.
Yes, exactly. And I certainly have experienced that when I took that contemplative life much more seriously, and you write it so well. You say, which is why seemingly ordinary moments like moonrises and lovemaking undo you. The veil has been pulled back. Everything feels inexhaustibly holy. There is nothing like that. And all I can think about, if more and more and more people began to have those experiences, what kind of world could we create?
Yes.
You also write, which I love, the contemplative life flows in a circular pattern. Awe provokes introspection, which invokes awe, and just goes around and around and around. And that made total sense to me.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. So the contemplative life is really, really important. I'd like for you to talk about something that has been very key for me, and that's non-duality. You write about non-duality and devotion for some of our listeners who are still maybe not understanding what that is about. Can you share and package that a little bit?
Sure, yeah. Well, most people have probably heard the term non-duality or non-dualism.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a philosophy that comes from ancient India. You know, there were kind of two streams. Well, there are many streams, but I'm going to talk about two. One was the devotional stream, bhakti yoga, which is all about that lover-beloved relationship that we spoke about earlier, you know, seeing God as the object of our heart's deepest longing, and yoga or spiritual practice, which has nothing to do with asanas that you do in a gym, but the path of yoga is a path of union to God, is about really awakening from the illusion that we are separate from God. But it's about, bhakti yoga is about loving our way home to our true self, to union with the boundless, absolute source of all love, the Supreme Being. The other stream of Advaita Vedanta is about, it's a philosophical system that says we are not separate from the One, from the Source. We never have been. And any sense that we are is an illusion from which we need to awaken. And so we engage in spiritual practice, primarily meditative practices, in order to wake up from that delusional state of separation.
Mm-hmm.
And so we insert this philosophical system into our everyday lives so that whenever we begin to suffer from the illusion of separation from God or from anything else, from the web of interbeing, we remind ourselves, Thou art that, as it says in the Upanishads. You are it.
Yeah.
And we use inquiry, like a methodology of inquiring, you know, what is real? Who am I? Who am I? Who am I? This comes from Ramana Maharshi, the 20th century Advaita Vedanta sage, who came up with this practice of stripping away all of the layers of who we think we are, until we arrive at that ultimate recognition of ourselves as not only like united with the divine, but the very same substance as God.
Mm.
But the problem in my mind with this system as it's been kind of adopted, especially in America, is that it has become very intellectual and disconnected from the heart and disconnected from the body. It's all like the philosophical system that we subscribe to but don't necessarily experience it right here where we live. Like people go into these non-dual states of consciousness that are sort of like comas. If you ask me, and I know because I've done it. I know
you've
that
been
state.
There, yes.
Very luring.
Uh-huh.
But it's totally disconnected in my experience from the heart and from the body. And that's where the feminine lives, right? The feminine is about embodiment and claiming all of reality as sacred, not as an illusion, but as holy ground.
I love the way you write, by the way.
Thank you.
In talking about non-duality and looking through the lens of non-duality, you write that you see John and St. Teresa, John of the Cross and Teresa, as a kind of Mobius strip, each one curving to complete the other while they both exemplify this dual, non-dual love dance. Their personalities lead them to express it differently, and their genders seem to have reinforced their distinct experiences. And then you go on about that. But this non-dual love dance, I just loved how that felt. And how can we cultivate that more in all of our relationships in our society?
Beautiful question. You know, the thing is, the path of bhakti yoga or love, the path of the heart, you know, the contemplative Christian tradition or the Christian mystical tradition, I should say, the Jewish mystical tradition, all of the mystical traditions across the spiritual spectrum emphasize this love relationship with ultimate reality. And so what I'm finding is if we allow ourselves to cultivate that intimacy with the great mystery, not confining it by personifying it, but rather allowing our hearts to be open, sometimes broken open, through our relationship with the holy as the source of love, then combined with some kind of contemplative or meditative practice, we'll find that the boundaries that are built around our hearts just naturally melt in the warmth of that love, and we experience an actual felt experience of unity with that which we yearn for. So I'm all about reclaiming longing, not looking at longing as some kind of disease of desire that we have to get over, but rather allowing our hearts to open to that essential yearning that I think is our birthright, and letting that lead us to that emptying, that nakedness of spirit that allows for that merging. Now, how do we take that to society, to a social level? I think it has a lot to do with, you know, like Brené Brown and allowing ourselves to be vulnerable rather than armoring ourselves and arming ourselves with all the answers, but allowing ourselves to not know and to listen deeply to the experience of the other and even the radically other, and to simply show up for what is with our hearts open, as my beloved lifelong teacher Ramdas says, keeping our hearts open in hell. That's how we take this love dance into the world and see change.
Yeah. And to do that, to be engaged in the world in which we don't burn out and give away too much of ourselves. And so you address that as well in this book about laying down our burden. And coming from somewhat of a healthcare background myself with hospice, I've come to see that oftentimes the healthcare industry can be very toxic, that they've lost heart and soul, that a lot of good people who are doing good work are wearing out and being exhausted. And you offer, I just love sharing your words, you offer this invitation. You say, here, come here, take a moment to set aside that list you've been writing in fluorescent ink, the list that converts tasks into emergencies. Have you ever experienced that in your life? Loaded question.
All the time. So I have a Sabbath practice, and I write about this in Wild Mercy, and it was really difficult to get going, but now that it's off the ground, which has been for about 20 years, by the way, I can't live without it. And that is when the sun sets on Friday. I mean, I am Jewish by birth, but not by training. My parents were completely non-religious. But But I have reclaimed some of my Jewish roots in some of the practices and the high holy days and things. But the Sabbath practice is the jewel that I've rescued from my ancestral tradition. Mm. So when the sun goes down on Friday, we light the candles, call in the Shekhinah, which is the spirit of Shabbat, the feminine indwelling, and then I set aside that to-do list written in fluorescent ink for the next 24 hours. I don't tend to my regular daily business. I don't give in to the compulsions, all those compulsions to do and to solve and to show up. Instead, I show up in a much more organic way in my body and in my relationships and with my mother, the earth. And I take a true Sabbath every week. And I've gotten to the point, Richard, where I can't even imagine life without it. I wake up on Saturday morning and there's a sense of tremendous relief and spaciousness that I don't have to go take care of all that stuff. And I travel a lot and I teach on the road a lot on weekends.
Yeah.
So I just bring it in to every community where I happen to be speaking or teaching. And people have just loved it, and I just share it widely.
You talked about your own Sabbath practice. I want to let my listeners know that at the end of each chapter you have in this book, you have a deepening practice. And in this one about Sabbath, you also give them some suggestions on what they could do to begin to practically flesh this out in their life, and I find that very helpful, so thank you for that. As one who also is an environmentalist, and I became an environmentalist because when I was a little boy growing up in Springfield, Illinois, we had woods behind our house. So I became an environmentalist because I fell in love with nature. And it's really important, I think, to talk about the importance of the mystic teachings, the female and feminine mystic teachings towards caring for the earth. Gaia, our mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, my dear friend Dina Miriam, who's the founder of the Global Women's Peace Initiative, says just what you said, Richard, which is that our impulse to protect the earth must come from, or does come, from an actual relationship with the earth as a cherished relative, or we have to, she always says, we have to fall in love with the earth again. And then, of course, we cannot help but respond to the cries of the earth that are resounding right now. And so I think that's really just what you said. And one of the ways that we cultivate that relationship, that intimacy with the earth as a beloved being, is by trying to make sure that we spend time in nature whenever possible, given whatever our limitations might be, whether they're, you know, physical disabilities that prevent us from walking, you know, or hiking or being in the wilderness, or that we live in the concrete jungle of a city, there are ways to reconnect with the earth on a daily basis. And if we do that without distractions, like listening to a podcast on our little ear headset or whatever, but to really just be present with the earth, then she becomes more and more of a real being that we cherish and want to nurture and protect.
And I love how this book flows, because in order to do that, we're also talking about going within, developing that contemplative life. So we are seeing through those eyes of love. And we start falling in love with the people in front of us, with the earth around us. How important is it to also embrace the feminine in activism and also in politics?
Yeah, exactly. It has to do with what we spoke about earlier, what I did. You're a very good listener, by the way. I'm doing all the talking. When I spoke about not necessarily having to have all the answers, you know, if we can stay in our wild feminine heart, and this takes great discipline, as much discipline as any other spiritual practice or methodology I've ever heard of, to continuously disarm our heart and be present to the presence of love. That's a rigorous discipline. If we can do that and keep ourselves present to what is rather than what we think should be, with all our dualistic opinions about who are the perpetrators and who are the victims in any given situation, but allow ourselves to be vulnerable, to not know, to open our hearts to the other in any of these political conversations, and as environmental activists, to stay connected to our bodies and to a felt sense of our love for the earth. These are feminine values. These are feminine values that I think we can and must cultivate.
Getting back to what I brought up earlier in this conversation, do you think, as a fellow citizen of this country is ready to elect, finally, a woman president?
Yeah, I mean, that whole question sounds to me like, can we elect someone with blue eyes? I mean, I don't understand how. This could still be such a question. I mean, yes, of course. And, you know, one of the things that I bring up in this book, and I think everyone listening can probably relate, is that often women in power need to kind of recapitulate the very characteristics of the masculine paradigm that has oppressed them in order to be successful, say, in business or in the sciences or in politics. So I think that what's the more interesting part of your question is not whether a person with a female body can make it in the boys' world of politics to the very top, which is President of the United States, but rather, is the world ready, and I think this is what you're really asking, for these feminine attributes of heart-centered relationality, vulnerability, fierce truth-telling, if we're ready for that set of attributes, both in women and people of all genders. And yes, I do think we're ready.
Well, I do too, and I think it's actually desperately needed. That's why I was so surprised when I watched a progressive talk show with some progressive people. There were some wondering about that, and I thought, we need someone who's inspiring. We need someone with vision. We need someone who's coming from a space of heart, and we need that feminine energy.
Yeah.
And not getting political on this show, but we have some fine candidates to choose from who could possibly serve in that role. So anyway.
We sure do.
Yeah. You also talk about the alchemy of art. I remember learning from creation spirituality years ago, and mostly from Matthew Fox's teachings, that in a sense, we're all called to be prophets and we're all called to be artists. So for my artist friends out there listening, can you talk about that and the alchemy of art and how that plays into this?
Well, I feel like that is another aspect of the feminine that's about wild creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Matthew Fox is a dear friend, and I love his via negativa, via positiva,
yes,
via creativa. And so the via creativa, the artistic way, the way of, it's like the yogas in Hinduism, the way to union with God, that creativity is a profoundly feminine space. And often I think that's exactly what's been missing from even the activist world that I've been part of, you know, my whole adult life. Well, even as a kid, because my parents were activists, you know, is that it's often about solving problems, which is, again, a very masculine mindset. And that when we allow ourselves to engage in the problems of the world with our creative responses, music, visual art, writing, poetry, theater, all of these ways that human beings allow ourselves to tap into that deep current of creativity, what's called in Hinduism Shakti, the life force itself, which is unbounded and wildly creative, then I think we find ways to not only refill our own empty cup, which, you know, the cup that gets emptied through our caregiving or our social activism, but we are able to refill the cup of others and give the activists a drink of water for their way and a different way in to look at the problems with humor, with aesthetics, with beauty. Beauty, as Dostoevsky said, will save the world.
I so agree with that. And the late John O'Donohue talked a lot about beauty, too. The invisible embrace, as a matter of fact. You have a chapter on dying, the ultimate spiritual practice. What I didn't know until I read this book was your daughter passed away many years ago.
Yeah.
And first of all, what was that like for you? I mean, it's a different journey for everyone, but can you share a little bit about that?
Sure, Richard. You know, I wrote a memoir, which is my favorite of all my books, really. It's called Caravan of No Despair. And that is the story of Jenny's death and of navigating the other side of her death, and really a lot about my relationship with the mystics who I was translating at the time. And it's also, by the way, about growing up in the counterculture, which I did of the 70s in Taos, New Mexico. But yes, Jenny died in a car accident at 14, the same day that my very first book came out, which happened to have been a translation of Dark Night of the Soul by St. John of the Cross.
Wow.
Yeah. And that obviously shattered me into a million irreparable pieces. Mm-hmm. And I knew just enough to know that I knew nothing, that the mystics I had been studying and the spiritual practices I had been practicing my whole life gave me just enough to allow me to simply abide in that shattered space of unbearable anguish and not try to get away from it, and yet not use any of the spiritual practices that I had collected or spiritual belief systems that I had, you know, constructed to save me. Nothing could save me, and I, you know, felt abandoned by them all, and I abandoned them all in return. And as a result, what I was able to do, not able, it doesn't like it was a mission I accomplished, but I somehow had the inner guidance to be fully present as an act of love, as an offering of love to Jenny. Like, I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm going to stay right here with this experience of losing you and loving you and longing for you. And that's what I did. And I had signed a book contract to translate The Interior Castle by St. Teresa of Avila. These are both, as you know, 16th century Spanish mystics. Mm-hmm. And I did the full 1 year Jewish mourning cycle of disengaging from the world for a full year when someone very close to you dies. So I didn't go out in the world. I didn't do any social things. I kept myself very close to home, and I had the great blessing of this book to translate, this really mystical masterwork by St. Teresa, The Interior Castle. And that became not only the place of refuge for me to rest in, to find sanctuary, but Teresa had in that book all the medicine I needed to tend my broken heart. Not heal it, not fix it. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't see grief as a problem to be solved or as a pathology to be cured, but rather as a state of boundless love. And Teresa's teachings really helped me be present.
Yeah. Do you have a book with you, this book?
My book, Caravan of No Despair?
No, Wild Mercy.
Oh, yes, I do.
I was wanting to know if you would honor me and my listeners as we close. I would love, with your voice, for you to read the opening prayer to the Shekhinah.
Oh, thank you, Richard. I would be honored.
Thank you.
Prayer to the Shekhinah. O Shekhinah, yours is the feminine face of the holy, the luminous moon who lights up the night as we travel from captivity to liberation, the pillar of fire who guides our way home, the cloud hovering over the mountain peaks, living sign that the drought is over. You are the indwelling presence of the divine. Whenever we gather to praise the One, you are here in our midst. When we cry out for justice, you make our hearts tender. When we stand with those on the margins, you make our legs strong. When we create works of art and parent our children and harvest our gardens, you guide and sustain us. You are the Sabbath bride, the beloved, returned from exile. You restore balance in our relationships and wholeness to our fragmented souls. You infuse our lovemaking with honey. You fill the cup of our hearts, which tremble with longing, with the wine of your answering love. You are the song of our homecoming. You are the Sabbath Queen, the Great Mother, who sits at the heart of the table, tearing off hunks of the secret bread that contains the exact flavor each of us loves best. You feed us all, the proud and the repentant, the believer and the skeptic, from your own hands. Your unconditional forgiveness dissolves otherness. O Shekhinah, we are the vessel for your inflowing. Your radiance requires the clay of our embodiment. Your flame burns at the core of the earth. Your warmth penetrates the seedbed and animates the seedlings. You bless the head of every animal and kiss the tear-streaked face of humanity. You are the vision that builds community, and you are our refuge when the fabric of community unravels. Be with us now as we navigate this landscape of mystery, where your most cherished attributes, wild mercy and boundless compassion, righteousness and wisdom, seem to be cast aside and trampled by imperious world powers, and we are paralyzed by helplessness. Help us. May we remember you and lift you up. May we recognize your face and celebrate your beauty in everything and everyone, everywhere, always. Amen.
And if this wasn't radio, I would have all of us just sit in silence for a while and breathe that in. The book is Wild Mercy, Living the Fierce and Tender Wisdom of the Women Mystics. I highly recommend this read to all of you who are listening. Mirabai Starr, thank you so much for the gift of who you are, the gift of this new book, and blessings to you.
Oh, I can tell that you've sat at many bedsides, Richard, because you have that capacity to hold deep space. And it's a joy.
I so appreciate her work. And I got to tell you, I love this book. We need the wisdom from this book in our society today. The great Carolyn May says, concerning Wild Mercy, it's mystical brilliance at its best. If you'd like to visit Mirabai online, please go to her website. It's mirabaistar.com. And that's today's program. I want to thank my engineer, Thomas Gesmondi, and my production coordinator, Angel Richardson, for helping to make this possible. I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire.